Brigadier Calvert, Real 4.
We train them, I repeat, 6 weeks solid, including Saturdays and Sundays, and then they had a week off. It's no good giving just weekends because we were a very long way from nearest bits of civilization. We train them very hard. I train them in demolitions and sabotage, but I also took them on physical training in the mornings, and I gave them lectures on their role in guerrilla warfare. I may say I'm very proud just recently to receive, we call these independent companies, later on they were renamed to commando squadrons, and I recently received an account of the second independent company's operations in Timor, where they operated for 13 months against up to 20,000 Japanese. And they, this is by C.D. Doig, D-O-I-G, who lives in Perth. They were raised in Western Australia, and they give thanks and high praise to our training and operations in Wilson's Promontory. Throughout his description, again and again, he says, and we followed the methods taught us at Wilson's Promontory and the methods of fighting as we were in Wilson's Promontory in dispersal and not, and so on. And so we get a very good write-up from them. I will just knock it off. I quote from his letter to me, "Your contribution will always be remembered and respected by these men who trained in the Promontory back in 1941. And I think that they did appreciate this."
What date is that letter, please?
The letter is 26/5/87 from 2nd Commando Association at Box T1646 GPO Perth, Western Australia, 6001. In that connection, the other independent, I'm jumping ahead now, the other independent companies were used in new, were, when the Japanese invaded, were used, cited in the Solomon Islands and in New Guinea. And unfortunately, they were placed under command of regular commanders who, instead of allowing their men to disappear into the jungle and operate from bases in the jungle which were well supplied with food and ammunition, they in many cases formed them as if they were infantry and to dig in and defend the ports on the side. So an awful lot of them were overwhelmed by the Japanese and destroyed, and it was only the independent company in Timor which, through circumstances, managed to get away from their, from the senior commander. In fact, they almost removed him, and continued to operate for 13 months very effectively on their own, and tied up 20,000 Japanese. If the ones in, it's easy to be critical, but if the ones in Solomon Islands, where of course there wasn't so much land, and New Guinea had operated in that way, later independent companies were used in that manner and were used ahead of all operations, and the number of weeks and months they operated on their own, some up to 200 miles ahead of our regular forces, was amazing, and I think they did as well as any force of that nature in the world in World War II. But they can be used wrong. You can see temptation for a regular battalion commander, whatever it is, to seize these men and put them into the front line, whereas, of course, they should be left to be overrun and to attack the communications. I always have advocated very strongly, and it's only recently been put into action, is that there should be a staff officer, like there is at divisional headquarters or corps headquarters, whichever is the senior command, who should have be called commander, as a generic phrase, SAS, and he should be advisor to the senior army commander, just like you have a CRE and a CRA and a CR signals and so on. And in my opinion, he should possibly have one leg or something like that, have seen action, so he can't jump in himself, so he can remain at headquarters and advise on how to use these men, because they can so easily be misused. I've always taught that they themselves should not think that they are precious, but other people must think of them as being precious and not misuse them any more than you misuse your signals personnel by putting them into the attack, unless it's very necessary. We train these men, and the main thing is not only to train them in the skills, but to train them mentally. And you've got to train people so that they can use their own initiative. I have trained special forces in different parts of the world, different nationalities, and one of the problems of training regular troops is that you have to break down the discipline to a certain extent. They've got to make it awaiting orders. The type of discipline, I always said, was needed by the independent companies and other special forces was the discipline of the fighter pilot, which is self-discipline, and that he must do a thing because he knows it's right to do it, but certainly not await orders. He should be given directives and not orders. And I think that this is very important, because time and again they've been misused and then criticized. The advantage we had were these Australians were, and I forget the name of their force, they weren't regulars, but they were called up as militia. And they had signed on, they had to have a special treaty in Parliament so they could operate overseas. And the result is they were civilians, and they had the civilian attribute of private enterprise and initiative, which at times can be a menace in a organized regular force, but was of a great advantage to them. So they took to this freedom of initiative like ducks to the water. And I'd say that the Australians, with this initiative, with this capability of improvisation, with their tremendous stamina and doggedness, and their sense of humour, which is very necessary because they get buggered up, they were ideal troops for this sort of operation. They can, and one advantage I've always said, and I almost like to underline this, one great advantage of operating behind the enemy's lines is you do meet such very bad soldiers there. All the best soldiers are in the front line, so it's far less dangerous to be behind their lines. And this is the thing which people don't appreciate. Type of other lessons learned to show that noise, just explosives by bombing or shelling, is not dangerous. And I would do that by lighting a stick of gelignite and putting it on some sand as we sat around a circle of about 10 yards and letting the gelignite go off with a bang whilst I carried on with my lecture and show them that nobody was hurt by noise. But then later I would put a shell or some explosive with metal around it, and I'd put up targets, sandbags or something, and then explode that, showing that the same amount of explosive behind metal was what is really dangerous. And so you could tell what was dangerous and what wasn't. And this illustration is a very rapid illustration you can give to show that noise doesn't hurt. I had given the same idea in Kent and Sussex, and I did the same with the Chindits and SAS. I think possibly I was taught this by officers who had been in the First World War at Chatham, who, when we were taught explosives, that it was noise doesn't hurt. But it's awfully important to teach new soldiers, especially soldiers whom you are training very fast. These independent companies, we train two Australian and two New Zealand independent companies at Lock Islet, and we were sad because the New Zealand ones weren't. There was a row, a political row, between Australia and New Zealand, and the New Zealand ones were withdrawn to New Zealand, but their training persisted. And two more Australian cadres were formed, and we were training them when we'd been out in Australia for almost a year, and they decided that they could carry on with themselves. So we were withdrawn. Freddie Spencer Chapman went to Malaya, and there'd been a colonel in the Indian Army who came down and was sent down to examine everything, and he put in a request for me to be commandant of a guerrilla warfare school for Mission 204 to China. Before I leave Australia, I would like to make certain points. Guerrilla warfare is to a large extent political warfare. You're dealing with people's minds, you're dealing with civilians, and later on we were taught by Wingate, but we learnt from other people, that you have to win the civilians on your own side. Because of this, you're liable to get entangled in political controversy. And wherever I've been, this political controversy, to larger or smaller extent, occurs. One should have, if possible, be protected from that. But in Australia, when we arrived there, the government was formed by the Liberals under Menzies, and there was one independent, and then the Socialists under, I forget his name, the Prime Minister the rest of the war, and so with exactly the same number of votes in Parliament as the Liberals. So it's a very unstable government. And Moorhood had to give talks to the War Cabinet, in which I was present as sort of ADC, and he had to stress It was his duty, he had been given, to stress the danger of the Japanese and how Australia must be prepared to defend itself. Now, Australia had been very generous after Dunkirk and had sent most of its weapons to Britain and even one of its brigades to Britain temporarily. Result is, it was fleeced of weapons. I remember Moorhood saying that the Japanese were building 3 60,000-ton battleships. I've since met one of our agents who saw these being built. And he told the War Cabinet, and they didn't believe him, nor did I. I thought this was an exaggeration. I thought a lot of what he was saying was an exaggeration. It turned out to be absolutely true. I had to be loyal to him, but the difficulty in life is to know where your loyalties lie. There are other things. I'll just give that one example where he was saying that it's the Japanese you've got to be afraid of and not operations in the Middle East. Then,
what's the connection between winning hearts and minds? And
well, you're liable to be used badly by your own side, you see. And also, your own side tries to get hold of these people because it's very easy to use a force trained as a guerrilla force to overthrow the government you're in, you see what I mean? And so they're apprehensive of that. And I can say, the second thing, I was in the Naval and Military Club when on leave, which I was drinking at the bar, and some people were showing great interest in me. And then they said, will you come and have lunch with us? And so I went in, and then page boy came along and said, you're wanted on the phone. Instead of leading me to the phone, this is in Melbourne, he led me into a card room where there was a number of officers saying, now, do you realize whom you're speaking to? That is the secretary of the Labour Party. And now you can say anything you like, because you're from a different army. But I can tell you that we will do everything we possibly can to destroy you if you start to get entangled in the political arena. So this gave me the fright of my life. And I went back to have lunch, and they'd obviously knew what was happening, and there was no more conversation about this. But I thought is, the point is this, is that any person engaged in training and teaching guerrilla warfare and so on is likely to get involved unbeknownst in some political problems, not only in the land where he's going to fight, but in his own land. And I think that people should be warned against this and should have some buffer between them and the politicians. That is the point I'm really making, I think. It's because what you're teaching, like in the when they went to Timor, they weren't told what the political side was. The Dutch were on our side, the Portuguese were neutral. They found the Dutch tended to surrender too soon. The Portuguese, they got on with very well, but they literally were helped most by people who were, by natives who were anti-Portuguese, because Portugal had been used as a sort of convict place. And so as a guerrilla, you're trying to do your best to achieve your end, which may be blowing up bridges and doing this, that and the other, but you may have to use people who are considered criminals by the local government. Same sort of thing happened to Wingate in Abyssinia. He was told to put the Emperor Haile Selassie on the throne. When he got near, he'd won a most amazing victory of capturing about 14,000 Italians and colonials with his force of about 500 strong, with some very, very good officers with him, including Thesiger and others. But it was a brilliant victory. And then the new commander-in-chief told him not to, he had Haile Selassie with him, told him not to go to Addis Ababa, because there are other missions in from Kenya and from elsewhere who were supporting other races, you know, other noblemen. And they, again, were doing, they were very fine people, Count Bentinck and people who later went to Burma before Wingate did. And Haile Selassie said, what do I do? You are supporting people who are trying to overthrow me. And Wingate, possibly lightheartedly, gave him the suggestion that he should send a signal on a King Emperor to King Emperor basis to the King Emperor in England, George VI, and say that I object to what's happening. Wingate, I should say, had marched into Addis Ababa with Haile Selassie, a most amazing march, and of course the crowd went wild, and Haile Selassie was put on the throne. Now the Foreign Office had doubts about all this. In Africa there were a lot of governments who didn't want to see a black emperor on the throne, might give other people ideas. Our greatest force in the Dominions was a South African force. They didn't want to have a black Africa. A lot of planters in Kenya didn't want to have a black emperor. So Wingate had been told by Wavell, who'd now been removed, his job was to put the King Emperor on the throne, which he succeeded in doing, and of course with the aid of victories elsewhere, and he got a hell of a rocket from General Platt, who eventually had him removed. But you can see he was trying to do his job, but it's so easy to get mixed up politics. As soldiers, we're taught not to get mixed up in politics, to avoid politics as all possible, but as in guerrilla warfare, you are bound to get entangled in politics, and possibly you should have a political advisor attached to you all the time. Especially during the Second World War, when there was, SOE had a policy, and so had the Foreign Office. And I may tell you that in a commemorative dinner of the SOE in the early 70s, we had three kings, anyway, four monarchs attended the dinner, including King Norway, King of Denmark, the Prince Regent of Holland, and the third one, I think, from Luxembourg or something like that. And the King of Holland got up and said, you know, we owe our thrones to you, because at the end of the war, the Russians didn't want kings on the throne, the Americans weren't too keen to have kings put back on the throne, and your Prime Minister, Attlee, was not very keen on kings. And it's only the fact that you put us back on our thrones before the war finished that we got our kingdoms back. I mention this, this is what the King said, I mention this to show how easy it is for forces operating a long way from their mother country to have to take political decisions. And I won't enlarge on it, because I think once having stated it, any sensible person can see it operate different parts of the world, with the Maquis in France. A lot of the best fighters were communists, but you didn't look to see the hands of your fellow soldiers before you. All you were interested in were people who could fight well. And this is a problem. I think it's worthwhile mentioning that.
Yes, certainly.
I think if we could stop now. There was some row again going on between Australia and Britain, and at one time I was sent up to Darwin to meet a chief of intelligence from the Far East, because I was worried whether Morehead was saying all the right things or not, and or whether Australia was saying the right things. And I said, look, I don't know what's happening. And I told them the story, what's happening there. And I said, you can tell me what's right and what's wrong. Well, shortly afterwards, we were flown out, and we felt as if we were slightly under a cloud. We had hoped, both Freddie Spencer and myself, had hoped we would get one of the independent companies and operate with them. But we weren't Australians, and we didn't understand the political side of things. As soon as I got to Singapore, I had to see, I can't remember his name, he's a major general in charge of intelligence. He had me to his house, and I talked, and then he had me back again, and I talked with a stenographer there, and he questioned me all on what was happening in Australia, and I told him everything. I said, I just don't know what's right or wrong, and this is from my own point of view, but we were very saddened by the action taken against the New Zealanders. Colonel Morehead at one time was put under arrest, or threatened to be placed under arrest by the Australians, and I had to hide him for 24 hours until the government changed. There were a lot of shenanigans like that going on, when all we were interested in was to get on with training these independent companies. Morehead had a difficult task. There were something like 8 different intelligence organizations in Australia. There was federal, and then there was the various territories, Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria, and so on. They all had their own intelligence organizations. There was police, there was navy, and so on. And he was trying to bring all these together. And intelligence organizations are very, very they take exception to anybody interfering with them and doing this, that, and the other. And so